Wilson even managed to sneak his way onto what could be considered the women's rights fraternity. One might assume, given his well-earned reputation as a philandering chauvinist, this would have been impossible. However, he was one of the champions of the Equal Rights Amendment, having co-sponsored and passed the ERA with Barbara Jordan back when they were in the Texas legislature. And his credentials went beyond that. Even though his Bible Belt constituents were militantly pro-life, he always voted for a woman's right to choose. He took this politically risky position because of his kid sister, Sharon, who had risen in Planned Parenthood to become the chairperson of its national board. He would have loved to tell his ardently pro-life constituents that he would vote their conscience, just as he always voted with them on opposing any kind of gun control. On that issue, he always said that his constituents would permit him any failing, but the one thing they would never tolerate was any vote to water down the right of an American citizen to bear arms. Failing to rail against the murder of the unborn was almost as dangerous, but Sharon insisted that her big brother not embarrass her by doing the wrong thing. There was almost nothing Charlie Wilson wouldn't do for his little sister. And so at the Lions Club luncheons, at the Rotary and the church groups, he would simply say, "I know this is one of those things that we're just not going to agree on, but I'm voting for choice." Somehow his pro-life constituents let him get away with it, and in the House that translated into another base of support for the unconventional congressman. By 1980, Wilson had established positions in a remarkably diverse network of congressional power centers, not just with appropriations and his own Texas fraternity, but also with the Jewish caucus, the Black caucus, the Hawks, and the women. Wilson was operating now completely outside the normal experience of American political life. Oddly, his pleasure-seeking that year even seeked to propel him into perhaps the most powerful House fraternity, that of Speaker Thomas P. O'Neill. Only a true insider could have appreciated the significance of O'Neill's simultaneous appointments of Wilson that year to the House Ethics Committee and the board of the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. And certainly almost no one could understand what possessed Tip O'Neill to make such a strange choice for the ethics panel. From today's perspective, the image of this philandering hedonist climbing out of his Las Vegas hot tub to render judgments on the conduct of his colleagues seems almost perverse. Even without knowing about the fantasy suite, a genuinely puzzled reporter had asked Wilson why he, of all people, had been selected for this sober assignment. Without missing a beat, Wilson had cheerfully replied, "It's because I'm the only one of the committee who likes women and whiskey, and we need to be represented." It was an outrageous statement. The Ethics Committee is supposed to serve as the conscience of the House and to rule on the conduct of its members. Any speaker should have been furious at Wilson for this needless provocation, particularly at a time when the House was caught up in its worst scandal in years, the Abscam sting operation. An FBI undercover agent disguised as an Arab sheikh had managed to lure six congressmen and a senator into a Washington townhouse, where the Bureau's hidden cameras captured them, one after another, taking $50,000 bribes. "I have larceny in my blood," exclaimed one of the congressmen as he thrust the bribe money into a brown paper bag. Another is seen stuffing the cash into his bulging pockets and asking the pretend Arab, "Does it show?" When the tapes were aired, millions of Americans were left with the impression that Congress, and the House in particular, had degenerated into little more than a den of thieves. It was a particularly bad moment for O'Neill, since nearly all of the Abscam bribe-takers were Democrats. That fall, when the Republicans captured the Senate and Ronald Reagan the White House, Tip O'Neill emerged as the unrivaled center of Democratic power in the country. He recognized that the Abscam investigation was taking its toll, that something would have to be done to restore public confidence. But the real crisis, as he saw it, was the immediate threat posed to those in his inner circle, who he relied on to help him run the House. A special prosecutor, Barry Prettyman, had just persuaded the House to expel one of the Abscam defendants, a veteran lawmaker, before he had even been convicted of anything. Never before had the House expelled one of its own members. With the zealous prosecutor at the helm, the committee was expanding its inquiry beyond the six members who had been indicted, and was rumored to be offering deals in exchange for testimony that would take the scandal into the Speaker's office. What finally caused O'Neill to draw a line in the sand was the prosecutor's move against his intimate friend and key political lieutenant, Representative John Murtha. The Speaker immediately summoned Charlie Wilson into his office to make an offer he knew Charlie would ultimately find impossible to refuse. "I want you to go on the Ethics Committee," O'Neill said. Wilson wasn't altogether sure if O'Neill was serious. "Tip, that's crazy. I'm not on the side of the Ethics Committee, and everyone knows it. They'd laugh us off the floor if you put me on that committee." The truth is, the Speaker was operating in this instance much like a spy chief. He didn't specifically tell Wilson that he wanted him to go rescue Murtha. He didn't need to. O'Neill knew that all he had to do was get Wilson on the Ethics Committee, and the rest would take care of itself. "Charlie," the Massachusetts congressman continued with a twinkle in his eye, "do you remember that appointment you've been asking about for the Kennedy Center board?" There was nothing Wilson craved more than a seat on the board of the Kennedy Center, and O'Neill knew it. To a married legislator, a lifetime appointment to the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts might not mean much, but for a divorced congressman going through a midlife crisis, with so many beautiful women to romance and not enough money to properly entertain them, it meant just about everything. Wilson still has a childlike enthusiasm in his voice when he explains why he lusted for that appointment. "It's the best perk in town. It means that I get the box right next to the president's box for the ballet when I want it. I get to go to all the cast parties, meet all the movie stars, and I get an extra invitation to the White House every season." Most important for Wilson, it meant that with no money down, he could dress up and play out his Good Time Charlie role with a beautiful new girl on his arm as many as 40 or 50 evenings a year if he liked, since he'd have free tickets to most of the shows. It was like a safety net for this broke romantic, knowing that on any given night he would always be able to give one of his girlfriends an evening of true glamour. For months, Wilson had been pleading and lobbying the formidable House Speaker to grant him this appointment, but the tough old Irish Paul hadn't come to rule the House by giving valuable perks away for free, and so Wilson's appeals had fallen on deaf ears, until now. "Well, it's a package deal, Charlie." O'Neill understood that Wilson's identity as a noisy braggart was perfect cover for the covert operation he had in mind. The word on Charlie was that he didn't talk, recalled O'Neill's former whip, Tony Coelho. From time to time, the Speaker needed to mount irregular operations, and Wilson was one of those irregulars Tip could count on. Wilson accepted the Speaker's deal. Delighted at his lifetime appointment to the Kennedy Center board, he was a happy warrior as he raced to the rescue of his imperiled friend, John Murtha. He had his work cut out for him. Watching Representative Murtha on the Abscam tapes is not an experience designed to make a citizen feel better about Congress. A member of the Ethics Committee at the time, he did refuse the bribe, but he did not exactly close the door on a future negotiation. "You know, you made an offer. It might be that I might change my mind someday." Others might have felt that Murtha had disgraced the institution and deserved to be prosecuted and thrown out of Congress, but Wilson genuinely did not. To begin with, he admired Murtha. The two were on defense appropriations together. They were both fierce anti-communists, and Murtha was a decorated Korean War veteran who had volunteered for 2 combat tours with the Marines in Vietnam, which meant he started off as a hero in Wilson's eyes. As Charlie framed the controversy, his friend had actually done nothing wrong. He hadn't taken the bribe from the FBI's sheikh. His only sin had been to say he'd think about it. And if the Ethics Committee members were even thinking of lynching a patriot like Murtha simply because he had lust in his heart, then it was time that the entire committee be put to a very public morals test of its own. Wilson arrived on the Ethics Committee just as O'Neill had hoped, like a wrecker. He told a Washington Post reporter that the committee was a partisan witch hunt, and that what was really on trial was not John Murtha, but the integrity of the House of Representatives. He was clearly spoiling for a fight, daring someone to take him on. That was not the way things are supposed to work on the Ethics Committee. The members were supposed to sit around in a sober manner, quietly review the evidence, and make their rulings. It was a horrible thought to have to go head-to-head with Charlie Wilson, a man who seemed to revel in his reputation as a rule-breaking, skirt-chasing sinner. Ordinarily, a special prosecutor in Prettyman's position could count on having enormous leverage over members of the committee. All it took to damage a normal representative's reputation was a leak to the press indicating that the member was trying to derail an investigation. But it was clear from his opening statement that Wilson would have liked nothing more than to battle it out in the press on behalf of an innocent man who happens to be a war hero.